Welcome to Reframed. Join us as we explore the concept of redemptive business in our unique context on the African continent.
Hello and welcome to the Big Change podcast. My name is Paul Kim, an entrepreneur and investor, and I'm an advisor to Zawani, a platform for business leaders where we share inspiring stories and provide access to innovative local resources while equipping one another for kingdom impact. Listeners will remember our Monday Christian podcast series, where I joined Sipsibanda to talk about a deeper integration of faith into our work, and then the Why Work series, which was a careful reflection of Dorothy Sayers' seminal essay on work. Today, I'd like to introduce you to our new series called Big Change, How Ordinary Christians Change Their World, and its host, Jonathan Wilson.
Thank you, Paul. It's a pleasure to be with you.
We'll get into your background in a little bit more detail just now. But first, can you tell us a story from your own life that I believe brings home a powerful point as we begin this podcast series? This story comes from when you first came to South Africa in 1998. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. 1998. It was just 4 years after South Africa had its first truly democratic elections. I had come here to work with a Christian NGO called African Enterprise, or AE, as we said, and for short. At that time, AE was well known for its evangelistic work, actually all across the continent, not just here, but also for their stance and for their activism against apartheid and against racial inequality. And they had done this in different ways. They'd done work in the church. They'd done work in the more secular sphere. They'd been working with political leaders right across the spectrum, actually. And they'd been quite instrumental in behind-the-scenes efforts that led to a smooth transition that we saw take place 30 years ago, actually, in April of 1994, in those first elections. So when I arrived in 98, this was all fresh. This was the atmosphere of this country as they just emerged from this very critical phase. And I was having tea one afternoon with my colleagues, and I asked them, how it was to be doing what they did. What was it like being in that situation under apartheid with this big system of oppression that was still in place? And one of my colleagues said to me, Jonathan, back then we always believed apartheid would end, but it was a massive system. None of us thought it would end in our lifetime, but it did. It did end in their lifetime. And that's why I think this story is important. Big change can happen. And I think we need to take heart from this and from many other examples in history that we'll look at when we go through this series, where Christians have patiently persisted, sometimes in seemingly very small ways, but in working on big, ungodly, unjust systems, and sometimes facing great hardship and opposition, but eventually big change happens. And God's power shows up even in the efforts of people who seem to be very weak.
Well, thanks for sharing that, Jonathan. And that is an incredible story, because not only we get to see the results and the fruits, but it's also real to us as South Africans that live in this country. And that is, of course, what this series is about, how ordinary Christians can be part of big change. Let me give listeners a bit of your background. So Jonathan is a co-founder and managing partner at Third Way Capital, which invests in small to medium businesses in sub-Saharan Africa. The mandate of Third Way Capital is very much in keeping with the theme of this podcast. Third Way backs and supports companies that have the potential to contribute to transformational change in Africa. Jonathan was born in the UK, but spent the first 17 years of his life in Indonesia, much of that time in a remote tribe. Since then, he has lived and worked in Southeast Asia, Europe, North America, and Africa. His career began here in South Africa, first in political mediation in the province of KZN, then in developing nation-building leaders in various sectors. Eventually, Jonathan's career took him back to management consulting with medium to large corporations in North America and Southeast Asia, and finally to the work he does now with Third Way Capital. Jonathan recently returned with his family to South Africa, where they now live in Cape Town. He's married to Tracy and has two sons, Nate and Sam. That's quite a varied background, and I have a feeling that there's way more to your story that tells us why you care so much about this theme of big change.
Thank you, Paul. Yeah, I'm definitely passionate about the topic of big change. And as we go through the rest of today's episode, but also future episodes, people hear a bit more of my story and they'll realize how the things that I've seen have shaped this passion. But let me clarify why we're using the expression that we are. It's partly to escape the inevitable baggage that clings onto terms that we frequently use today, like kingdom impact or kingdom transformation or missional. Today, you'll often hear people talking about things like redemptive business or redemptive investing. So the redemptive language is quite common as well. But these are all great terms, but they mean different things to different people. And so for this series, we'll stick mostly with the expression big change, which has a very specific meaning behind it. It simply refers to large-scale change in society. That's big change. And Christians have long played very significant roles in different kinds of big change throughout history. Scripture has a lot to say about what characterizes big change so that it really does reflect the kingdom of God. And Scripture has a lot to say about what characterizes our words and our actions when the work we do towards achieving big change is actually in step with the God of history.
I love that. I love that because I think of my life group who I've been journeying with for the last 6 years, and we talk about highly topical things, population decline, the extreme hyper-individualization that's taking place in our society. And in all of that, as much as it's an interesting topic to discuss, at the end of the day, it's like, well, what can we do about all of this? And so people see this machine going and they feel like a single individual that can't do much, and then they're, well, might as well continue with our lives as we originally thought we should pursue it. And so I love this language. It's moving away from the theological complex terms that most people don't know how to actually implement in their life to, well, it's big change we seek. And how does God do that over time?
Yeah, Paul, you've set that up very well. But let me back up for a bit. So listeners have already heard from you that I've lived on these four different continents. I've lived in very different cultural settings amongst very different kinds of people. But everywhere that I've lived, people that I encounter all long to see transformation of some kind in their societies and their environments. But Christians in particular have a longing for that that's rooted in the vision that Scripture gives them to care about their world and what God is doing in it. And so most Christians that I know have a passionate belief that God is a God of history, that He works in history, that the kind of work He does is rooted in His love, is transformational. What they're less clear about, which you just alluded to, is, well, do I have a part in that? And if so, how? I'm just an ordinary person. Then within that, there's other complexities. So some Christians believe that there's a tension between, well, people need to know Jesus. They need to know the saving power of God. That has eternal implications. That's what I should focus on. And temporary things, well, I mean, they're significant and they're challenging, like poverty or social and political injustices or challenges that are going on with our created environment, but surely what I should focus on is the eternal. So that's a tension that some people feel. And yet they know that these issues are there and they don't want to ignore them. I think others believe that as Christians, we have a responsibility to share our faith and to put it into action. But when it comes to business, is business the right thing? You know, for doing that, isn't business a bit grubby, a bit dirty? We worry about the money side of that. We've seen how money has power. It distorts people's minds and it distorts how they behave. They can become greedy and oppressive and extractive. And business, we know business does all of that. We've seen it. And so business has done a lot of harm to the world. So is business really something that God would use as part of bringing about big change? I think that's something that Christians bump up against, is can business have that kind of impact? But I think most common is what you touched on, is that most of us feel caught up in our smallness. And that could be the smallness of me as Jonathan, you as Paul, one of our listeners in their small world as they see it, or it can be how we see the church community. The church community is also ineffective, weak, small. There's much more powerful agents in our world, governments and militaries and businesses and corporations and so on. And so the problems are big. There's big powers out there doing things that, how can we stand up to that? Maybe it's better to just stick to, like you said, getting on with my ordinary little life.
Oh, I love that. And I, you know, as you sit and you explain, you know, I think like what practically happens in our head when we hear this, when we hear these stories. And I just wonder, often we tell the end of the story, like when they became a hero, or, and we don't actually go back to, well, when they were an ordinary person and start the story there. And so if we're always just talking about the exciting phases of the heroism, as encouraging as it, or as exciting as the story sounds, it actually robs ordinary people of the ability to appreciate where this hero started, whatever the hero is, right? Whether it's Nelson Mandela, whether it's an amazing business leader that you admire, they started in an ordinary place because everyone gets born. Everyone grows up in a family, and we need more of that. South Africa has left apartheid behind, and all citizens of this country, whatever their race or other distinction, are now free citizens. But this country is now in the grip of another set of serious troubles, of corruption and crime, of the legacies of racism and wealth inequality, of broken institutions such as medical care and electricity supply. Then you layer on top of that larger problems like a heating climate and its frequently destructive impact on people's living environments and livelihoods. It all just seems too big to change.
Exactly. And when I lived in South Africa previous to our recent return, that was in the late 90s and the early 2000s, back then there was this excitement about nation building. And today, having returned here just over a year and a half ago, my wife and I have encountered much more cynicism and frustration in all sectors of society. And when we moved back here, we got one of two reactions from South Africans. Thankfully, most were thrilled, but there were some who would almost be indignant, as if our return here was somehow validating a broken country. And it made me think, is that mean that the right thing to do when a country is in trouble and broken is to abandon it to its dysfunction? I don't think so. But that is a cynicism that exists because after the great liberation that took place in 1994, this country has nevertheless continued to see many, many difficult things. I think as Christians that we need to return to Scripture and see that Scripture actually has a vision for big change. It is possible. History shows us it's possible. And there's a role that we have to play in it. Whether the time that we're in, as you alluded to, is the time that we see success, or whether the success is seen by another generation, that's not for us to choose. But we do have a role to play. And so this series has been built to inspire, to educate, and to equip listeners with, firstly, to have a much bigger vision for the size of challenge that we can take on in God's grace. And then secondly, a deeper knowledge and understanding of what it takes to do that and to participate in big change. And then thirdly, listeners are going to hear practical examples of how Christians today are trying to live this out in different spheres, but especially in the marketplace. And then finally, this series is going to help listeners understand that in the Bible, there isn't a tension between the good news about Jesus and the work that we have to do in the world. I think Christians have falsely separated as spiritual and physical what we should really think of as the inward and the outward. There's an inner transformation, but it has to be manifested in an outward transformation, and not just at the individual level, but at the community level, at the state level. So this is what this series is seeking to equip people with.
So again, Jonathan, I maybe just want to ask a question there, and which is, like, there's so many parts to what you're saying there that sounds great, but then you think about it a little bit more and you realize if that's what needs to happen, then, you know, like that's hard work. So, I mean, you think about, a Western individualistic society. We want to see the impact of our work, or the fruit of our labors. Just the one element, how do you teach a culture that's never had to do this before the patience to say, I'm not going to eat the fruit of my labors. It's going to be eaten by the next generation. Like, how would you even get that across to our Christian brothers and sisters living in a country like South Africa?
So, what you've done there is you've just landed on one dimension of a very complex problem. It's exactly what this series is intending to explore. Like, how do you take on something like that? And then how do you start to take the steps that to you might seem insignificant, but actually could become very powerful? What I call the accumulation of impact over time.
Sure. Okay. It reminds me of that saying, I think it goes, we overestimate how much we can accomplish in a day, in a week, and we underestimate how much change happens in 10 years. So Jonathan, Zwani is a resource built for Christians in business, and that's the focus of this podcast too. What would you say to listeners who are not Christians or who are not in business?
That's right on. Those are good questions. Well, so firstly, as listeners are hearing, yes, this series refers to the Bible. It refers to the work of Christians in history. It's directed at a Christian audience at a certain level. But I have many friends who are not Christians, especially in the business world. And the vast majority of them really want to be part of making a difference in this world. And if any of you are my friends are listening, then I would encourage you, please hang around, because I think you will really appreciate the content in this series. I think you'll find it encouraging. I think it'll give you insight and tools, and you'll find it helpful even if you don't share the Christian faith. Then with regards to people who are, maybe they are Christians, but they're not in business, again, I think this podcast series will still be very helpful to them. I know many who are in churches or NGOs or in government who really, again, want to be part of making big change happen. And there'll be a lot of principles in this series that will apply to them, even though we are looking primarily at business-based examples. But then that returns us to the question, well, why are you focused on business? Well, partly because Zwani does, partly because that's the world that I occupy, but also because the marketplace itself is where most people are trying to make life work. That's where we try and make it happen, where products are created and services are offered that help people make their lives work in very ordinary ways often. So it's in the marketplace that as Christians we can bring an imagination that's inspired by the Bible's view of this world, and that can then lead us to contributing to big change through various business initiatives. We can engage in innovations that transform how business is done. So this is the kind of thing I'm talking about, that we can bring to the market products and services that solve actual problems and that contribute to powerfully to healing and renewing where society has been broken through the impact of poverty, through the impact of oppression or injustice.
Okay. So I think why we even have to deal with this question is because we live in a society that does siloed thinking, like I'm in business or I'm not. And that's actually not true, because business will tell you who's a key stakeholder, the customer. And that's you on the other side purchasing products and services. And I don't think most people realize how influential they are as consumers, because at the end of the day, many businesses, or probably all businesses, exist to serve their customer. And they really take into account the needs, the preferences, and the desires, and the pricing points from their consumers. But on the other side, you don't think you are in business, or that you don't have an impact on business. And that's clearly false. So I'm glad this speaks to everyone in the ecosystem.
So Paul, what you just said there about the role of the customer is really important. It's something that we're going to get to later in the podcast series, but I'll touch on it briefly now. And that is that in business, there's all kinds of accountability mechanisms. And one thing as Christians, we always understand that's actually something quite healthy in business. And one of those mechanisms is a business can't survive if the customer doesn't buy its products. So the customer holds the business to account to deliver services and products that actually work. That's when businesses or the business system is at its best, is when those accountabilities are in play. And so, yes, Christians, whether they're the customer or whether they're the one leading their business or participating in their business, can understand these accountabilities and that they can be used for good.
I love how you connected the dots there, because I think most people, to your point earlier, think of business as a bad actor. But it's actually a little bit scarier than that, which is, well, if business is serving customers, then, well, hold on, who actually is the bad actor here, ultimately?
So what you've just said there, Paul, actually brings us to the heart of the matter, which is that these big complex systems at their heart are made the way they are by how people behave. And the gospel speaks to that directly. So as we look at big change and as we explore it today and in the episodes to come, we're going to see that that's actually a really important part of it. And that's why we need both the inward and the outward aspects of big change. Let's get stuck in on that.
Let's go for it, Jonathan.
So this entire podcast series that we're going to work through is anchored in that part of the Bible known as Paul's letter to the Colossians. Nearly 2,000 years ago, Paul's one of the key founders of the Christian church. In fact, he started out as somebody who persecuted the church, but then he came to know Jesus. It transformed him, and he became a leader in the church and quite significant in his influence. And he's writing this letter to a relatively obscure community of Christians in the city of Colossae, which is or was in what we would now think of country of Turkey. So Rome was at the height of its glory then. It had pacified a whole empire across the Mediterranean basin through its military might. It prided itself in enforcing the Roman way across very diverse regions and very diverse ethnic groups. And in contrast, the Christian community that was starting to develop in those days, whether it was in Colossae or Antioch or Rome itself, it would have been a very small community, like tiny numbers of people relative to the general population. And it was made up at that time largely of individuals who were often the despised of Roman culture. Slaves, for sure. Women, who were seen as second-class citizens by and large, and then the poor. And while they were Christians of higher social standing that would have been in the church, they also would have been frowned on for the fact that they were basically making this close association with the despised classes and with those who are second-tier people, so to speak, in that society. So Christians were not actually just ordinary. They were less than ordinary in the Roman Empire. They were weak, they were insignificant, and they were despised. But Paul's letter to this pathetic, rather ragtag mix of despicables is incredibly majestic. You'd think he was writing to the nobility of some great kingdom. But in a way, that's actually what he's doing. It's just not a kingdom that any Roman would recognize as meaningful or real, because there's no actual political structure. There's no emperor or king that is visible in some seat of power. But yet, that is exactly what Paul is doing. He's writing to the nobility of a great kingdom. It's the kingdom of God. This letter to the Colossians is all about the big change that God is doing in history, and what their part is in that big change as his people. So the letter is perfect for people like us. We know we aren't anything special, but we have in fact been called by God to make a difference in this very big and complicated and broken world of ours that we've been talking about, and which seems to be controlled more by powers that are like the Roman Empire than it is by the kingdom of God. And yet, we know that the kingdom of God is actually the greater power. So we're the people of another king. And the section of Colossians that we're about to hear speaks exactly to this matter of who really is on the throne.
I love that language. We are people of another king. And I love that language because we don't think that way. We're individual. I am my own person. Right, so there's no baseline attachment to a group or neither to a leader, because we're supposed to determine our own path. So it's a double whammy. Firstly, which allegiance are you part of, which is this is addressing, right? But secondly, we don't have that as a mental model in Western society. And yet we need to, if we want to see big change happen. We have to believe and appreciate that we serve under King Jesus and not under whatever else we're pursuing this side of new creation. It's just I just realized now, as you're saying, like there's a huge perspective shift that needs to take place in all of this for ordinary Christians to participate.
Well, let's hear what Colossians has to say.
May you give thanks to the Father who has enabled you to share in the inheritance of the holy in the light. He has rescued us from the tyranny of darkness and relocated us to the kingdom of his dearly loved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. He, the Son Jesus, is the image of God the invisible, firstborn over creation, because in him everything was created, in the heavens and on the earth, the visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church, the beginning, firstborn from among the dead, so that he might become first in the order of all things. For in Jesus, God was delighted to take residence in all his fullness, and through Jesus to reconcile all things to himself, making peace through the blood of his cross. And you were once estranged and enemies in your mindsets and evil deeds, but now he has reconciled you in his physical body through death to present you holy and without fault and without accusation before him, provided you remain in the faith, firmly grounded and immovable, and not shifting away from the expectant hope, the good news which you heard, the proclamation in all creation under heaven, of which I, Paul, became a servant. This reading was taken from Colossians 1, verses 12 to 23.
Can I ask you a question on one of those verses?
Yeah.
It's a beautiful section, clearly riffing on Jesus. But the thing that I struggle with is, what does it mean in him, all things hold together? Like, surely gravity is doing that, or, you know, whatever other things that God already created and they're just functioning. Like, why do we need Jesus to hold all things together?
That's a fantastic question. So this whole passage is echoing the Genesis story of God creating heaven and earth. It's also echoing Proverbs, where wisdom is present with God in the creation of the heavens and the earth. And so what Paul seems to be saying is that almost like that Jesus, who's the Son of God, and who is the image of God in the created order, just like you and me and every other human being is made in the image of God. Jesus is that singular primary image, that all of creation has been brought into being through him, through as a template. So it was like Jesus and all that he is in all his wisdom is the template, the frame within which, or from within which, creation has been created. I think just at this basic level, as Christians, we understand that while God has created a universe that is characterized by quite astounding laws, like when you hear scientists, when you hear physicists talk about the laws that govern the universe, it's extraordinary how finely tuned they are. But for us as Christians, we know that we couldn't even draw our breath if God, at the most basic level, was not upholding this universe that we live in. But what you're raising there is really bringing us to what this text is focused on, which is that what God is doing in his restorative work is bringing creation back into its proper and fullest expression that he always intended it to have. And the root of that, or the template for that, is Jesus himself. So, but let's back up a bit, because I think this brings us to exactly to this question, which is, what does the world actually need? What does it need? If you look around us today, what would be our answer to that question? And we might say, well, we need more effective systems of justice, or we need governments that are peaceful, not warlike. We need the poor to be uplifted in some way. We need scientific breakthroughs that reduce disease or that address climate change or deal with pollution. We need families to stay together. We need less divorce. We need kids who grow up well. We need strong communities that thrive. These are all things that the world needs. And there are many types of salvation on offer. Systems of government, left-wing politics, right-wing politics, free market, socialism, that's at the high level. Right down to the ground level today, where somebody might be advocating we all need mindfulness, or some trendy solution like that. In the world that I move in and that you move in, Paul, the world of business, it's everybody is intoxicated with tech. And, we have tech solution for everything. We have fintech, we have ag tech, we have femtech, which is with female women related. We have blue tech. We have reg tech, that's to do with regulatory systems. We have a tech solution for everything. And we believe that if we just find the right technical or technological solution, we can unlock salvation of some kind. And so these are the kinds of salvation that are on offer out there. And many of them in their own right are fine, or they can be fine. But here's the kicker. We worship whatever we think is powerful. And if we think that tech is powerful, that's where we're going to put our time and our energy and our effort. If we think that, as many parts of the world do, that our ancestors are powerful, that's where we'll put time and effort and energy. So some of us put our efforts into politics. Some of us put our efforts into religion or the law or healthcare or business. And as I said, these things aren't in their own way necessarily bad. They can even help, but they won't save us.
There's an element there that's maybe even deeper, that we, even in the, as Christians, we struggle with. But in a country like South Africa, there's this deep embedded belief that knowledge, education, will solve all our challenges. If people knew better, even in Christian circles, you know, you think of this focus on Bible study and, you know, it's part of the process of renewing one's mind. But if it's not coupled with habits and practice to implement what you know is true, then you get the fix of I know more, but your life is no different to anyone else. And so underlying all of that is, if I just knew better, I'd be a better human being. And you keep serving at that altar by grabbing for more and more knowledge, but actually doesn't lead to a transformed life, because God has made the world to be more than just knowledge. Anyway.
Well, and so what do we need? Better systems and structures? Yes. And this podcast is going to get to some of those things where Christians can participate in something that addresses an injustice or something that addresses something like poverty. These systems and structures that we create will reflect the character of the people who create them. So we're interested in the inward and the outward. So let's, again, pull back to what this section of Paul's letter to the Colossians is saying and ask that question again. What does the world need? This letter is telling us what God is doing for all of the world. And what he's doing is he's bringing it back into alignment with Jesus. He's doing it through what Jesus accomplished on the cross, yes, but he's bringing everything back into alignment with Jesus. And Paul uses the language of reconciliation to describe that. He describes God's entire plan for creation through the language of reconciliation. Now, this is probably both interesting and maybe even engaging for South Africans, but maybe also challenging, because reconciliation was the language we used to describe the transition out of apartheid and into a democracy. And yet today, I run into people who are cynical about reconciliation because, well, it didn't really work. It didn't really solve the problems. There's still injustice. There's still oppression. The legacies of apartheid, you still see when you cross a highway, you know, which is on one side, the homes of the wealthy, and on the other side, the shacks of the poor. But I think that's because we have a faulty understanding of reconciliation. And I'm hoping that as we go through the series, we will see how rich the biblical view of reconciliation actually is. Because it's about not just estranged people coming back into a better emotional state with each other. I mean, they're no longer feeling hostility. It's actually where all things in creation are brought back into their proper relationship, proper order. And that includes, as Paul says here, not just people. People are reconciled to God through Jesus' death. But ultimately, he talks about thrones, dominions, authorities, rulers. The language he's using there is the language of both spiritual powers and what we would call secular powers, or spiritual, supernatural powers and political powers. And you could probably throw into that other kinds of very significant human power systems like corporates, big corporates. I mean, there are single companies in this world that have revenues that are higher than the GDPs of some countries in this world, you know, so we do need to think that corporates are powerful too. And it says that all these supernatural and earthly powers are going to be brought back into proper relationship with God through the work that Jesus has done. Basically, this larger theme of reconciliation, just unpacked about the powers, the authorities, the rulers, and that it's more than just the restoration of our emotional state with each other, but it's actually much larger than that, more comprehensive.
If you've been enjoying the conversation so far, please review this episode to help shape future content on Reframed.
So this conversation reminds me of something I came to realize for the first time in one of the Monday Christian episodes or themes, and that was the one on rest, if I remember correctly, and going deeper into what the Bible was meaning when it spoke about the concept of shalom or shalom. And I hear that word and described, and it's just serenity and peace and a lack of conflict. But actually, the Bible doesn't just take it to that neutral state of kind of nothingness. It actually says it's beyond that. It's the presence of flourishing as well. So I think most people, when they hear reconciliation, they think, oh, just go back to neutral. And I think that's kind of faulty thinking, because the Bible doesn't present this picture of a neutral state of affairs between God and us. It's we take on the sonship, we take on the rewards of what Jesus was rightfully his, and now we get to enjoy that. He didn't just, you know, fix our sin and then just say go off on your own. I'd love to hear more about, you know, how this reconciliation actually plays out in biblical terms.
Listeners will have to be patient, because we will touch on some of that today. And then we will go into it much more deeply later on, because there are real issues, let's say in South Africa, that remain today because they have not yet been addressed. But they're the result of the apartheid system and how it governed this country and other aspects from that time. The biblical vision of reconciliation is one in which those things also get addressed in time, not just the rectifying of a relational estrangement. And so we're going to come to that. But I want to come back to what you're saying about shalom, because our vision of shalom comes from the first chapters of the Bible, from Genesis chapters 1 and 2 especially. And in this passage in Colossians, Paul's echoing Genesis. So let's jump back a bit to Genesis chapter 1. And people may remember that in Genesis chapter 1, you have the creations, as the author puts it, of the heavens and the earth, which is really a Jewish way of saying of everything, of all the known, of all the universe. And what's described there, well, it starts out with saying that the earth was formless and void, or form without form and empty. And then you have the 6 days of creation flowing out in this rhythm in which God is creating spaces that are ordered spaces where before it had been, things had been formless. And then he populates those spaces, right? And so there's this idea that there are spheres of existence, and that within those spheres of existence, there are plants, animals, and other created beings that have their rightful place. And these spheres of existence are obviously interlocking. But what we have there is a picture of orderedness and harmony in complexity. Right? There's all kinds of difference in creation, but it's not difference in conflict. It's difference in harmony. And this is shalom. This is this vibrant, flourishing universe of God's with all these different components that interlock and interact, but they're in harmony. We also know from Genesis chapter 3 that this very existence got dealt a blow when Adam and Eve in that story eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and basically seek to be God themselves, to take to themselves his omnipotent, omniscient wisdom, power, and so on. They want it for themselves so that they can be the ones who make the call on how to live life and how the world should work. And of course, that's the root of all that is broken and harmful in creation today. That flows out into the ruin of humanity, and it flows out into the ruin of the world. Later on in Romans chapter 8, Paul talks about the fact that all creation groans as it waits for our redemption as human beings. And why? Because we were made to be the lords of creation in the truest sense, where we enabled its flourishing to happen. And so Jesus, who is the image of the invisible God, that's why he's the template on which all of this order is brought back. And so in this vision of shalom that we have in Genesis, that gives us the framework for understanding what Paul's talking about when he talks about reconciliation of all things in heaven and on earth to God in Christ. And so, yes, the destination is shalom, but it's shalom in this really rich, full and vibrant sense. And it's a shalom that is made possible as human beings are redeemed and become the images of God they were always meant to be in the first place, which of course is actually going to, a lot of what we talk about in the coming series is going to be unpacking what it means to reflect God into creation.
So that's such a powerful set of ideas there, because again, I think about, you know, how would I normally see this, and it's like there's bad and there's good, remove the bad and ta-da, you've got the right solution, right? It's a toolkit of saying eliminate or remove. This idea of, well, hold on, that's not the only set of tools you need, because sometimes it's just the right ordering of things and the right relationship that fixes things, as opposed to completely removing what would otherwise be seen as a bad actor. In medical terms, I think, you know, everyone well, goes to the doctor to get antibiotics to destroy all the bad germs, but they don't realize, well, actually, you also need the good germs to populate it afterwards. Otherwise, you may end up in a worse position. It's the good bacteria part of the equation that we don't speak about because we're so fixated on this bad thing that must be removed. So reconciliation, again, is not just about removing the bad things in the relationship, but it's also about figuring out what are the good things and how do we right order them relative to each other, so that it works in harmony. I think that was one of the words you used, as God intended it. It's a powerful way of thinking, sure.
Yeah. So us ordinary humans actually have a very powerful influence in the world and in creation. And currently, it appears to be largely for the worse. In that, you know, when you think of how damaged and broken our world is today, I don't just mean the systems that we live in, the societies that we live in, but the creation itself is suffering. And yet, at the same time, our rescue is going to be the key to the restoration of creation. And of course, within that comes all kinds of dimensions of the restoration of creation, including the marketplace, which we're going to get to. But let's move a bit more into the richness, as I said earlier, of this model of reconciliation that we're finding here in Colossians. And I'm going to take us through four R's. So four words beginning with R that give us four dimensions, you could say, or four lenses through which to understand God's reconciling work in his creation. And the first is rescue. And the second is reorientation. The third is repair. And the fourth is reordering. I'll unpack each of these. So let's start with rescue. So in Colossians chapter 1, verse 12, Paul is encouraging the recipients of that letter to give thanks to the Father. And he says, who has enabled you to share in the inheritance of the holy in the light? So the holy being those who have been set apart for God's call. He has rescued us from the tyranny of darkness, and he has relocated us into the kingdom of his beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. There's a lot going on in those verses. We can't maybe touch on all of it today, but I want to touch on a couple of key things. Let's talk about this language of redemption. So in order to rescue us, we had to be redeemed. Redemption is the language of liberating someone from slavery. And the way you did that back in these times was you would pay off the owner of the slave so that they are now free and they can have their own freedom to act in society as a normal citizen would in that Roman context. So redemption is liberation from slavery. And what Paul is saying is that because of the power of sin in our lives, we have been under the tyranny of darkness. So we've been in slavery to darkness. And it takes redemption to free us from that. But what is that redemption? It's the forgiveness of sins. It's our own sin. It's our own need to be our own God. It's our own need to be our own power broker in creation, in our world, that actually enslaves us. We become enslaved to ourselves. But there's also this sense that we become enslaved to the dark powers, which we'll come to in another episode. And so God rescues us by forgiving us our sins. And then in doing that, he relocates us. So we move kingdoms. We move from the, in fact, he doesn't even give the kingdom of darkness the dignity of being called a kingdom. He just calls it a power. And he moves us to the kingdom of his beloved son. And that is now, we've been completely relocated. We've been given a new citizenship, as we touched on earlier. We have a new king. And we are under, but it's not just any old king. This is the king who defeated the powers that we are now under. This is not a relocation that might get undone if we, you know, don't quite get things right. It's a done deal. We have been relocated into the kingdom of light, the kingdom of the Son of God. This comes to the very center of how big change happens. It cannot happen, first and foremost, by our effort, because our effort will be distorted by our sinfulness. Big change begins when God rescues us. So it begins with God. God is the author of big change. And I saw this firsthand growing up, as I did in that tribal community, which is called the Yali people of central Papua in Indonesia. These are people who, they were animists, they were actually cannibalistic, they were very warlike. These were people that, while there are many aspects of their culture that even today I think we would consider to be very rich, like very communal, for example, nevertheless, it was very broken and very toxic. Treatment of women, for example, was horrendous. When I was a little boy, they estimate that 10% of women committed suicide in this culture. These people encountered the message of Jesus, and there was a massive swing in that culture over the space of about 15 years that led to a comprehensive social change and movement. But it began with people realizing that God was offering them rescue out of their sin and out of the powers of darkness. So in 2011, I went back to Papua for the 50th anniversary since the gospel had been brought to them. And the main theme of that anniversary, this is their language for describing what they've been through, is we were rescued out of darkness and brought into the light. And so that's what God does in this work of reconciliation. He rescues us out of the darkness and brings us into light. And in doing so, he rescues us to become his sons and daughters, his image in creation. He's actually restoring us to that. So that's rescue. Secondly, let's look at the lens or the dimension of reconciliation that we call reorientation, which is also a dimension of reconciliation. It's a reconciliation of our minds to God. And we're probably very familiar with the words in Romans chapter 12, where Paul says that we are to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. But also in Colossians 3, chapter 1, Paul says, so if you've been raised with Christ, the Messiah, seek the things that are above where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on earth, for you have died and your life is hidden with Christ in God. And when Christ, who is your life, is revealed, then you also will be revealed with him in glory. So in these opening words of chapter 3, Paul is saying that we have to set our minds on things above, but he's not saying set your mind on some other place, some paradisial, non-earthly place. That's not his point. He's saying, set your mind on things above where Christ is seated in authority. He's saying, set your mind on Christ, who is King of heaven and earth, and from there, live your life. And so we have to be reoriented in our minds as to who is King. So I'm going to tell you a story that actually ties together the actual work of reconciliation, in this case at a political level, with this kind of reconciliation that we're talking about, the reconciliation of our minds to God. So when I first came to South Africa, and I was involved very quickly in a political mediation process in KwaZulu-Natal, in Richmond. And the violence that was going on there was hectic. Hundreds of people were dying each month because of the political violence. And so my organization, we got involved in a political mediation process to try and bring about peace there. In the work that we were doing, we worked with various different kinds of political leaders, but one of them was a man called Sifiso Mkabinde. Sifiso had left the ANC and moved over to the UDM. The ANC hated him for doing that. And Sifiso also had a reputation of being a murderer. And when we first started to communicate with him, he had just been released from prison, where he'd been held on murder charges. He'd been released only because the police had illegally tapped his phone, so the judge threw the case out. And at that point, he was on the run, and we needed to talk to him because he was crucial to the peace process. To make a long story short, it's a great story for another day. We eventually met with Sifiso and his bodyguards in a dark back room of an obscure little panel beater shop in a corner of Pietermaritzburg. And we walk into this room, and my boss, who is the head of AE, Michael Cassidy, who is very skilled at this kind of thing, he, you know, we come into this meeting together, and I'm wondering, how's Michael going to handle this? How do you handle a warlord who you need to come into a peace process? And I don't remember Michael's exact words, but he said something like, well, Sophiso, you got away by the skin of your teeth.
Oh, sure, what a start.
And I just about fell off my chair. And I was one, you know, seeing if his bodyguards were starting to get twitchy. And what Michael was saying was, you know, you got let out of prison. You really shouldn't have. You should still be there. And you're probably guilty of those murders, but you're out. And that tells me that maybe God's up to something. So what might God be up to that you've been released from prison when you should actually still be there? And Sophiso said, I've been thinking exactly about that.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was unbelievable to watch. So to make a long story short, Sophiso did agree to come into the peace process. But before that happened, there was about 10 minutes where he was weeping and where he gave his life to Jesus.
Yo, no, my jaw's on the floor. That's, yeah, it's unbelievable.
So we agreed that we would meet with Sophiso and help him talk to his wife and his family about this change that he was making. So a week later, we go to his house and we meet with his wife and his children. And we explain his journey to them. And then he takes me over to a bookshelf. And on the bookshelf is a photograph of him in military, in combat gear. And that's from when he was with the Mkhonto Sizwe. And he said, I used to be a warrior for the cause, but now I serve a different king. And he says, it's changing everything. It's changing my entire life. And he said that 1 week after giving his life to Jesus. He changed his allegiance. He had to think about his entire existence through a completely different lens. That's what it means for ourselves to be reoriented. There's a lot more we could say about that, and we will, again, in coming episodes. Then there's the third R, which is the R of repair. And that's where reconciliation brings about healing where there was brokenness. So not just, well, it could be healing relationally, but healing in other ways, where the sins of human beings have led to damage in people's lives. So we're talking here about the tyranny that sin brings. Colossians 1 verse 13 refers to that. We've been rescued from the tyranny of darkness. And the tyranny of darkness, the tyranny of sin, becomes tyranny in our homes. You think of broken marriages, abusive husbands, tyranny in businesses, tyranny in governments, which we know about. We have that history here in this country. So throughout history, Christians have had a distinct role to play in situations of tyranny and injustice and the damage that these forms of tyranny have caused, but not necessarily in the way that we might think. So if we go back to the story I just shared about Sophiso Mkhabinde, let's say he's become a Christian, he believes he's now to live for God, and so he takes up his gun for God and uses military power to try and achieve what he thinks or what he thinks the Bible teaches is a good and just society. No, he didn't do that. That's not the God way. It's not the Christ way. He set down his gun. So in the same way, Christians throughout history have brought about a very different approach to tackling the tyranny of sin. And it's happened in all kinds of ways. You know, the first hospitals that we know about in history were the hospitals that the Roman Empire set up to support their military. So these were hospitals used purely to support your fighting force.
Oh.
You know, make sure that they don't get completely decimated from disease or illness, you know, as a result of injuries on the battlefield. But the first hospitals in the way that we think about them is hospitals that are there to care for the sick of anybody who comes across the threshold of the hospital. Those were founded by Christians in the very early centuries of the church's history. Offline, you and I were talking about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. You know, again, a political process, but not using military might, not using the normal techniques and tools that the world uses to achieve an outcome, which is usually always some exercise of power to overcome, like you said, to deal with what is bad, put it away, cut it off, do whatever. No, instead it was reconciling process to bring about or to contribute to the political process in this country. But I want to use another example from my own family's history. And this will give you another sense of, again, why I care so much about this stuff. So my great-grandparents went to work as missionaries in the Congo. This was in the late 1800s, so around 1893, if I recall correctly. And in fact, my great-grandparents and other missionaries who went to work out in the Congo packed their belongings in coffins for the journey by ship to the Congo. And the reason they did that was because they knew before they went that the mortality rate for missionaries working in the Congo was so high. I don't remember the stats, but it was very high. And so they knew that there was a chance they weren't coming back to the UK, which is where they were from. So they go to the Congo, and they're there to preach the good news. They're there to plant churches. But while they're there, they see that the Congo, which was basically at that time, unlike other parts of Africa where countries like the UK or Belgium or Germany had colonized and officially and formally colonized parts of this continent, the Congo was under the Belgian king himself. It was his own private estate, effectively. And we don't know the numbers for sure, but under the management of his people, the Belgian Congo became a place of untold suffering for many Congolese. The estimate is that 6 million died over just a handful of decades as a result of Belgian effort to extract rubber from the rainforests of the Congo. And they had this quota system. To enforce the quota system, they would inflict barbarities on the local people, like cutting off hands and things like that if they didn't fulfill their quota. They'd burn villages down. They would massacre people, all to extract rubber so that somebody back in Belgium or the US could drive their new car with its rubber tires. People like my great-grandparents and later on my grandparents, who also were missionaries in the Congo, saw this was happening. And although they could have said, no, my job is of the kingdom. I'm here to save souls. I'm here to preach the gospel, which they did. They also put their lives at risk and put their careers at risk by meticulously documenting these atrocities, assembling all the evidence they could, and then sending file after file after file back to the UK. And these files were used to lobby the Belgian government to bring an end to these atrocities. And in the end, it worked. It took many years, and it wasn't just missionaries. There were others involved in this as well. And the end result was that eventually the Belgian king released it, and the Belgians took it over as a colony and tried to run it in a more proper way where there was a rule of law. Now, the Congo has been wrecked by the damage that caused. But nevertheless, that is a role that Christians played in bringing about the end of very significant atrocities. And that's how Christians could play a part in reconciliation that is about addressing damage, addressing brokenness, addressing harm that is right in front of us.
Well, I mean, I'm sitting here and I don't know what to say to that, because just the way you started the story, they pack their bags and their belongings into a coffin. And there's so much to unpack there, excuse the pun, but like they knew what they were heading into, and yet they still did it, and God honored that. And I wonder how many of us have that courage and the desire to do that. In these micro decisions we make every day, we try to stimulate our brain, entertain ourselves, eat what we want. And that's how our decision-making is formed each and every day, and that's all we're practicing. Yet your grandparents decisively put themselves on a trajectory where they had no way out but other than to be into God and offer that up, and then got to see the fruit of that. And I just think, how do I become more courageous like that in setting my life up for the everyday to be for Him? And I just feel like a coward right now, right? Now, what are the challenges that I sit with? Oh, should I have this meal or that? And that's the complexity of my day to day. It's hugely encouraging to be able to hear the story from the grandchild of these missionaries. Yeah. So thank you for sharing that.
Well, and the thing is, probably the average Christian is a coward, and it's the grace of God that enables them to take these sorts of steps, you know. But it's because we're living by a different set of laws. We are serving a king who is higher than the kings that can, in a sense, punish us for doing good. And we've been relocated into this other kingdom. That's actually the place we operate from in order to be the sons and daughters of God in this world. So we're coming to the last R, which is reordering. And we've touched on this a few times already, but that's where reconciliation results in social systems and structures being properly ordered, being brought back into the kind of order or brought into the kind of order that delivers the flourishing that we were talking about before. That is the kind of order that is characterized by righteousness, by right conduct, and by justice. Now, we're going to touch on this more in future episodes, but you can't have a truly just society without reconciliation, because only reconciled people treat each other with justice. For so long as people are alienated from each other, one will behave towards the other in an unjust manner. And we see that the reordering that we long for is ultimately has to be rooted in relationships that are truly loving. And of course, that sounds grand. You can say it easily, you know, off the tongue, but it has to come from this deep work that God does in us, such that we can say this is a structure built by love.
I mean, there's a lot there. I immediately think to just the way you phrased it, maybe just in my own words, the extent to which we have tasted reconciliation is the extent to which we can rightfully pursue justice. So if we don't know the cost of justice, then how can we actually aim for it? And reconciliation requires significant effort to get there. And it is only from that place, and you can actually see real justice for others and for yourself without being, let's call it, selfish in the process.
So I have a friend in government in a fairly senior position. And one of the main roles of his department is welfare grants. He's a Christian. He's inspired by the love of God and the love of people that flows from that. And what he is trying to do is to switch up how the granting system works in this country, so that instead of grants being simply a handout to those who are unemployed, and that in itself is a worthy cause, and it's an understandable utilization of that capital, what he's trying to do is turn those grants into seed capital for entrepreneurs, particularly in the township economies. So taking an existing pool of money and reimagining how it can be used. And what I love about what he's trying to do, this is the level of structure. This is a level of policy. What he's trying to do is to say, what is the most loving way to deploy this money in a way that builds people up and gives them dignity and agency, rather than treating them purely as victims who must passively receive somebody else's compassion or, you know, beneficence. So will it work? Well, it's early days, but it's a really good example of somebody trying to reimagine an existing government structure and system to bring about something that we could define as reconciliatory. People being brought back into right relationship to work, right relationship to their communities, right relationship to themselves as they take on more dignity, as they bring out their own creativity as entrepreneurs, as they build solutions for their communities. That's a wonderful illustration of this work of reordering. So in the coming episodes, we'll unpack all of this a lot more. And the four R's, the four dimensions of reconciliation that we've just walked through, going from rescue to reorientation to repair, to reordering, those are going to form the framework for all the studies that we do over the next 11 episodes around how God is unfolding his work of big change, of reconciliation of all things to Jesus. But we're also going to address tough questions like, well, what about when we don't succeed? What about when we fail? What about when Christians are actually part of the problem, when they've actually contributed to the sins that trouble our world? These are real questions, they're important, and we're going to look at them as well as we explore what it means to be part of God's work in big change in our world.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for that. I hear all of that, and it sounds incredible, but at the same time, it's daunting. There's a lot going on there. And as you were finishing, the picture that came into my mind was the story of the the five fish and the two loaves. And I suppose my prayer for all of us as we kind of walk this journey with you is to be either become as naive or courageous as a little boy who offered up his five loaves and two fish and trusted that Jesus could do something with that. And that's where we focus, not worrying about, oh, but what this and then that. And like, what is the thing that I can offer up to Jesus each and every day? So that brings us to the end of this episode. Thank you so much for taking us on this epic series. Jonathan, thanks for having me around. And it's been such an incredible experience kicking the series off with you. And I am looking forward to hearing the rest of the episodes with your audience.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. This episode of Reframed was brought to you by Ziwani, a community of business leaders who partner together to live out their kingdom calling in the marketplace within Africa. Ziwani is a Mergon initiative. To know more about us, visit our website at ziwani.com. That's ZIWANI.com.